Hi, you're listening to a Pod for Good Media Network podcast. We are a network that provides podcasting production services and a supportive community in which podcasters can thrive. If you're a podcaster local in the Tulsa area, we would love to have your show on the network. If you are interested in starting one, we would love to help you get started. Find us online at podforgoodmedia.com and fill out our Pod With Us form. Happy podcasting.
Episode of In Depth with Dion. In this episode, I speak with Dr. George Henderson, a civil rights scholar, professor who helped shed Norman's Sundown Town past and open doors for thousands after him. He just announced his retirement after nearly six decades at the University of Oklahoma. But first, the rundown. In local news, Keith Daniels, Greenwood's favorite documentarian, has released a trailer for a new series on breaking the stigma against Black fathers. The 13-part docuseries will be coming out soon. Make sure to follow Keith Daniels on all his socials for updates. In state news, with unanimous support, the Oklahoma Senate passed a bill Monday aiming to standardize how county jails operate in a state that has the second highest rate of jail deaths in the nation. And in national news, as anti-immigrant laws leave many jobs vacant in the state of Florida, lawmakers are considering a controversial bill that would lift restrictions on child labor to fill in the gap. Senate Bill 918 would remove all work limits on 16 and 17-year-olds in the state of Florida. It allows employers to schedule them for unlimited hours during the school day without breaks and up to 30 hours during the school week. And those are some of the headlines. This is In Depth with Dion. I'm your host, Dion Osborne, recording from Tulsa's historic Greenwood District. And now, up next, you'll hear from Dr. George Henderson. Dr. Henderson, I don't even know how to introduce you because you are just a phenomenal individual from your career, from your civil rights work, and just your personality and the way that you interact and approach other human beings in this community. And so I wanted to first of all say thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come and speak with me on the podcast. And I wanted to be the first to ask, you know, how is the retirement so far? You just announced your retirement.
This is a foreign territory for me. I haven't, for years, Barbara said, you don't tell people that you retired the first time I retired from university. She says, it's a lie. It's a lie. No, you're busy. Well, in answer to your question, I don't think I will ever retire in the traditional sense of not being busy and doing the work.
Right. Of course. And I can't really see you stopping because your whole life has just been on the move. And for people who, you know, maybe don't know your whole story, you've gone through it so many times by now. I want to help you out and kind of share a little bit of your story for you. You know, when it comes to growing up in Detroit, right?
Growing up in East Chicago, Indiana, starting my professional career in Detroit.
Mm-hmm. And so once you were starting your career, what took you to Detroit and what was the work that you wanted to accomplish there?
When I got my doctorate, I just wanted to teach. But while working on the doctorate, the jobs that I had involved community organization, working with the Detroit Housing Commission to get better mortgage conditions for the residents and cleaning up the neighborhood. And then the Detroit Urban League asked me to join as director of community services. And that meant getting out, working with the NAACP, the Black Muslims, you name them.
And so that is what allowed you to cross paths with
Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., Roy Wilkins Jr., you name it. As director of community services, meant exactly that, the community. And we didn't take sides. The only sides that we took was for the people in the community.
Hmm. I mean, that's just incredible. You know, a lot of people today know you as a civil rights giant and distinguished professor at the University of Oklahoma, but you had this entire life before then. Tell me, what was it like interacting with those great civil rights leaders, and what did you learn from them?
You know, it's interesting. That's a very good question. While I was doing it, and I didn't put it in perspective. It was just work. And I remember, for example, having the conversations with the different groups and individuals and saying, okay, now what next? So it was never a focus on George per se, but the work that we were trying to do together. In some instances, we were trying to get to an end goal, but our methods may have been different, but that wasn't the point. The point was that people needed help, and somebody had to do it. And, you know, as the old saying goes, many are called, but few are chosen. Well, my creator chose me to do this work.
And you have lived a life that others hope to accomplish just a piece of what you've accomplished. Talk about the moment that you realized you were going to be going to Norman, Oklahoma. Why in the world would you even think of going to Oklahoma?
You sound exactly like my wife.
This is the 1960s, right?
1967. I got my doctorate from Wayne State University in educational sociology. I was the 13th African American in the United States to have that particular doctorate.
Wow.
Which meant that I could have gone anywhere. Offers from East Coast, West Coast, Midwest, South, it didn't matter. And I received, Barbara and I, you know, were trying to decide, okay, now with the doctorate, you've done this community work, you work with the Detroit Public Schools and all of those things, you want to be a teacher. Let's decide where that's going to be. So we talked about the various options that I had. Mm-hmm. And doggone it, in the middle of that process, I received a call from the University of Oklahoma, Professor Richard Hilbert, chair of the sociology department. And he said, Dr. Henderson, we heard that you are on the you're going to be on the market and you'll be looking for a job. Would you consider the University of Oklahoma? And I said to myself, hell no. But in order to cut the conversation short, mm-hmm. I said, Dr. Hilbert, in my most northern arrogant voice, there's something that you need to know about me. What is it? He asked. I'm a Negro. He said, that's your problem. Do you want to come to the University of Oklahoma?
Well, okay.
And with that, I said, oh God, I've got to meet this white man. And I told Barbara that I accepted an offer to go to Oklahoma, but I said, Barbara, what I'm going to do is that I'm going to do three things. I'm going to put that white man in his place. And I'm going to see Indians, and I'm going to see the football field where Prentice got set all kinds of records. Mm. Well, as I was flying into Detroit for the interview, as the airplane from Detroit crossed the border from Kansas to Oklahoma, I saw the red earth. And I said to myself, this is it, meaning Oklahoma. And the voice inside of me said, yes, this is it. I didn't understand what that meant. Okay, I'm in Oklahoma. I had interviews. They were not impressive because the people who interviewed me, I had the largest lecture interview of any faculty member ever hired at the University of Oklahoma. I had members from all of the colleges and other miscellaneous individuals. Why? We had a riot in Detroit, a race riot, 1967. And they wanted to hear about the riot, and I wanted to talk about my work as a teacher. And there was very little of that. But I don't know why, but I said, I will come on the condition that you give me 2 hours of free time with students. I don't know why I put that in. And on my time with the students, they said, Dr. Henderson, we want you. We need you. We have courses on the book about urban sociology and urban education. And none of the faculty members that we have here and or had here had that kind of experience. You do. We need you very much. And another one said, we probably can't pay you as much as the other university. Oh, he was spot on. Now, either I'm insane or I was called to do something. The salary that they offered me was $16,400. I was making $16,700 at the Detroit Public Schools.
Wow.
That was not an increase. Now, there is the kicker. I was going to teach 12, four classes, 3 hours each, every semester. No problem. I love teaching. And one of the students said, you probably can go elsewhere and get a better offer. Yeah, I could. The offers that I had on the table would have given me a raise of $10,000 to $20,000 more than I was earning in Detroit. And another one said, if you come here, you'll be a big fish in a small pond. You go to those other universities, you're just going to be a little minnow. You're just flapping around. I like the analogy of me being a whale. But the buddy wasn't right, and I knew it. And at the end of the interview, one of the students said, whatever you do, please think about us here, us students. We need you. And that reverberated in my mind. We need you. And actually, I was thinking to myself, I need you too, this place called Oklahoma. So on the way back to the airport, I told Professor Hilbert that I would accept a position, a joint position with education and sociology. When I got home, I said, Barbara, we're going to Oklahoma. You'll love it, honey. She said, well, how much does it pay? I said, oh, you're going to love Oklahoma. It's a nice college town. And I kept talking to George, stop. How much does it pay? $16,400. She said, that's less than what you're making now. Mm-hmm. Either I was insane, which she bordered on that, or there was a reason for going. And my reason was simply this. On the plane back to Detroit, I have imaginary conversations with my creator from time to time. And I had anticipated that there would be a discussion between Barbara and myself about the pay. And the voice said, you do the work and let me worry about the other income. Hmm. And it came. It absolutely came. I got speaking engagements. I started writing books and all of the other things so that I could do that work. So coming was a challenge for me, but it was where I should be. And I didn't understand that truly until, oh gosh, if I turned down five presidencies, three of them at historically black colleges or universities.
Wow.
I turned down the last, oh gosh, four vice presidencies and five deanships and on. Heck, everybody seemed to want this guy called George Henderson. And he's in Oklahoma. And I'll never forget, for some reason, this is where Barbara and George and the family should be. First, the first message that I got, I wanted to go to really Dillard University in New Orleans. That they wanted us. And Barbara, dazzled them because she would be the matriarch of the campus and we would be living on campus and she would interact with the young students, the females in particular. And the chair of the board, after they had said, we want you, she said, oh, forgot to ask, how many children do you have? And I said, seven. She says, oh, my goodness. The president and his wife must live on campus, and it can only accommodate three or four children at most. We had seven. Barbara was crestfallen, and I was too. We got back to the hotel, and about midnight, I said, Barbara, God, let me screw myself out of a presidency. She laughed. But that was a sign. It was a message. If we had had two or three or four children at most, we would have gone to Dillard. We would have been there. Oklahoma was where I should be.
Sorry to interrupt. I'm just thinking about how do you encapsulate decades of change into one conversation, you know, and I'm just thinking of, I guess, when our paths crossed.
Oh, yes.
You know, it was, you know, during the SAE, you know, mm-hmm. the former frat that had made the racist chant, and then the student group OU Unheard started forming and organizing, and you were their early supporter, their early advisor to to their actions. And I want you to talk about, this wasn't the first time that students on campus had dealt with racism. I mean, you think about trying to change the name of the, one of the buildings from Dean, from the historically racist, one of the racist founders of OU in the 80s, to decades later helping students to change street names, and the most nationally recognized event, which was the SAE racist chant. Talk about what was that like from your perspective when that happened and your role.
It was the kind of opportunity that I dreamed about in terms of making and being a difference, not just for me and my family, that was important, but more important, but extending my family to include the students. First the Black students, then the white students, then the African, and so forth. But let's start from 1969. Mm-hmm. The Black students wanted to start an organization. They wanted a campus-wide organization. There were Greeks and then non-Greeks, and there were athletes and non-athletes, and they all wanted to do something about racial segregation and discrimination. And the organization that they created was the Afro-American Student Union. And Melvin B. Tolson Jr. and Lyndon Marie Tolliver and I were their advisors. And that was the group of students who indeed challenged the university. You talk about sit-ins and boycotts and pre-ins and all. They had them. They did everything in the playbook that I was trying to do and did some of the in Detroit and more. Mm-hmm. It was a teaching opportunity. And this was my laboratory, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I saw how the pieces were fitting. And I made some conditions. I will be your advisor, but you must do the work because it's about you and for you mostly. They assumed the leadership roles. They made the decisions. I supported them. And I decided that I could support them in places where they didn't have complete access to or first access, the president's office and the vice president, the dean. I could speak for them in those meetings. I could be that lonely Black voice saying, whoa, just a minute, think about this in terms of the students. And I did. I was fortunate. When I came, it was George Lynn Cross's last year, at the university. He and his wife did something that had never been done at the university. She invited my children to have a tea party. Six girls having a tea party in the president's house. Mm. And having that kind of invitation, Cleo Cross, bless her. George Lynn Cross loved basketball, but so did I. I came from Indiana. Hey, we played basketball all year round. Football was something we did waiting for basketball to start. So I loved basketball, and so did George Cross. And he spotted me in that little field house across the way, and he asked someone, is that Professor Henderson over there yelling and making a fool of himself? and this is that's Professor Henderson. Would you invite him over to this side to sit with me? He invited me up. He says, we both like basketball. Would you consider you and your wife just being here with us? So we became their seatmates at the basketball games. But that also gave me access to the president, access that no other professor had at the University of Oklahoma at that time, directly to George Lynn. So I could use that, talk about a platform. I used that platform to advocate for the students, mm-hmm. initially the Black students and later the other students. Now, from that protest, there were several others. And who's the professor that they would come to and say, hey, Doc, what do you think? Big mouth George. And at one point, it came to me. I've got to chronicle what happened with the creation of an Afro-American Student Union and the few years thereafter. And I wrote Race in the University. Mm. And that was the book that the unheard students read about the challenges, the creation of an organization. They decided not to create an organization, but the tactics and the strategies. And so the unheard students came to me first in my home. We talked informally and then in my home and then later on the university about tactics and strategies. So here I am again. And I remember a dean saying to me at one point, you know, you could get lots of awards and honors if you just keep your mouth shut and stop getting involved in the student activities. Hmm. And I said, I didn't come for the awards and honors. I came for students. And that's been my motto. I came for you. I stay for you. And I work for and with you. So with that experience, they had read Race in the University, and we talked about the strategies. And I'll never forget the night before the walk, the silent march with the unheard people.
2015.
One of the students called and said, Dr. Henderson, would you please come and support us at the rally? I said, of course I was. And I was front row and listening. And to see their eyes when they saw me walk in early in the morning, kind of, and join them, and they asked, do you want to speak? And I said, no. You speak for you, for the group, not me. You're empowered. Use this platform today to do what you can to create whatever change you want to happen. They did. I was so proud of them. I tell this. Every student that I've interacted with, one way or another, became part of my family. And I would always tell my classes, you're Henderson now, and we're like the mafia. Nobody gets out alive.
Okay. All right. That's one way to put it. Well, I am grateful to, you know, consider myself part of the Henderson family, because I feel like I kind of caught the tail end of your advising, you know, a few years after the SAE.
Yes.
You know, I want to say around 2017, 2018. Then City Councilor Bria Clark had reminded people about this decades-long battle to remove the name of a former Klans leader from a street sign near OU. You know, you had worked with students in the 80s to remove the name on a
DeBar
from the OU building.
Yes.
And this was kind of trying to finish that battle, I guess. You know, and there was a lot of opposition. You know, Norman City Council is seen as more of a progressive local government in this state, but there was still a lack of understanding of the significance of the issue and a lack of understanding of why it needs to be addressed. But you stood with students, you stood with me and my friends, and you came to those city council meetings, you used your voice, your platform. And ultimately, you know, thanks to your support, I really feel like it was you who got that over the edge, because people realized, like, maybe we can ignore these students, but we can't ignore Dr. Henderson.
I remember when I came to the university and several people said, you know, you're just a token. And I said to myself, yeah. And then I said to him, there are good tokens and bad tokens. Good tokens are able to open the door for the next one and the next one, the next one, because I learned that from Jackie Robinson. So being able to be a part of what you as students were doing about the DeBar thing, I didn't have to think about that. That was a yes. I was going to be there. I was going to be with you. I was going to be for you. And it was never a question. The only question was when, where. You tell me, I'll be there. I'll do that. Call it a labor of love if you want to. Call it karma if you must. But I say, call it doing the work of humane people. And that's what my creator put me on this earth to do.
You know, the OU Daily right now is doing a series on the 10-year anniversary of the racist chant from SAE and the fallout, which led to diversity trainings that you helped to form, diversity trainings that now state government is trying to ban, and the federal government is trying to ban, when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion. But a lot of people don't see what you do for students and people in this community outside of what's happening at the meetings, outside of campus, outside of the cameras. And I just really wanted to take some time to thank you for what you did for me, because I'm not sure if you remember, but, you know, while I was doing all that activism, my grades were really suffering. I was not going to class, you know.
Of course I remember.
And, you know, I'm not going to lie. You know, I had an academic suspension.
Yep.
You know, I just was not, you know, giving enough priority to my classes. And I reached out to you, and this was either in the middle of the DeBar stuff or after it. I reached out to you asking for your support, asking if you would write a letter, you know, to the office to give to reconsider my suspension. And you did that. And I would not have graduated if it weren't for you doing that.
I physically went over and talked to the dean of students about you. And yes.
I didn't know that.
I did a lot of that behind the scenes advocacy work. I considered it part of my work and part of my calling and part of, I had to do it. And yours was a case, it was a no-brainer for me. Here's George Henderson, remembering when he was in college. I didn't do any of the things that you students were courageous enough to do, but I remember, doggone it, in my freshman year in college, I did everything except study. And I said, good gracious, if we're going to try to keep this young man out because of GPA, I should not have graduated, because my grades looked like, oh, shame, boo-hoo, go home. And a professor intervened, chair of the sociology department intervened on my behalf. And I said to him, I owe you. He says, no, you owe other students.
So you're paying it forward.
I was paying it forward. And then I realized that paying it forward has no end point. You do it as long as you can, as much as you can, while you can. And I was pleased when I knew, when I walked out of his office, that you were going to be given another chance. I knew that. I don't know how many times a dean or a vice president says, George, I'm going to do this for you. I said, no, you're going to do this for the students.
You've been paying it forward for 56 decades.
Yeah.
58 years.
58 years.
I want to leave you with one last question. Of course, a lot of people were sad to hear about your retirement, but also happy, because you deserve time for you, you know, and to not be fighting on behalf of everybody else. So what I want to know, Dr. Henderson, is, how do you feed your soul, and what are the things you want to do in this time of your life to feed your soul?
That's a darn good question. I spent all of my life, and certainly when I was teaching and doing the advocacy work, with the permission of my children, I spent more time with other people's children than my own, but I had their permission to do that. So the way that I kind of make that up a little bit is that now that I have more time, I'll give more attention to my grandchildren and my great grandchildren. Now their parents missed that time, but they look at me and they said, "Doggone it!" And then they would smile and said, "That's okay, Dad. We know we gave you permission to be gone." Now I don't have an excuse for my grandchildren and great grandchildren, so I'm going to be there with them. But there's something else. Barbara and I need more time. She sacrificed a lot too. In fact, Barbara was the chair of the Norman Human Rights Commission that opened up housing and employment in Norman. And most people know her, and they refer to me as her husband in Norman. Outside of Norman, Barbara's my wife. And so these dual roles reflect the time that we spent helping. But how am I going to spend the time? I'll probably have another writing project of some kind. I get thoughts and pieces and snippets of things that I want to say, and the way that I say them is through books. I may collect the thoughts and put them on scraps of paper, but the question that you ask, what am I going to do? I missed the classroom. And I knew I was going to miss the classroom when I made the decision, but also my mind was ready to go, but my body simply had reached a point where it was not able to perform at the level that I wanted to teach. So consequently, I've got to find another place to, well, let me say it this way. When I was outside of the classroom, I just barely existed. When I was in the classroom, I was alive. The students gave me a reason to go from day to day and do the things that I did and to share them with them. I'll be very honest. I don't know what's going to happen to this person with all of the free time, but I do know this. When Martin Luther King Jr. said, I've been to the mountaintop and I know I will not be with you much longer, we didn't want to hear that. I've told my family that I've been to the mountaintop and I may not be with you much longer, but the time that I have, I'm going to try to make it quality time. I feel good about the life that I've lived. I feel good about the things that I've tried to do with others. But from my perspective, it was never I. There is no I in we. There's no I in us. And so I'll keep doing what I can for you and the others as an elder in the village. And we elders will continue to tell our stories. And foremost, I'll do what I do with every audience, every group of individuals that I meet. I will continue to love you. Love is the glue that binds me with other people. This last thought came to me. The very first time that I saw the students in the classes, good gracious, my first class was a small sociology class of 250 students. And there were five minorities. And I looked out at all of the students, and Roberta's flag song came to me. My love, the first time ever I saw your face, the first time ever I saw the faces of the students, yours and the others, it was my love. So what will I do? In my spare time, I'll find ways of making my loves proud of me.
Well, you've loved on so many of us, and it's impacted all of us in ways that we are still just now realizing. You've helped to change the culture. You've helped to bring voices to people who felt voiceless. And your work and your story continues to inspire the next generation. So Dr. Henderson, thank you so much for joining the podcast. And I look forward to reading your next book too.
Thank you.
Thank you, doctor. I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Yes.
Okay. Bye. That's all for now. Thank you for joining us on In Depth with Dion. Watch on YouTube, on Patreon for exclusive and behind-the-scenes content, or listen anywhere you get your podcasts. This episode is presented by the Black Wall Street Times. And special thanks to Jesse Ulrich, our producer. I'm Dion Osborne. Stay woke.